What will it be like to live and work in the smart environments of the future? The smart home industry is still in the early stages, but can already give us a glimpse into that connective, interactive future. To help us understand the power and potential of smart homes, we welcome Kent Dixon to the show. Kent is the CEO of Younomi, the IoT company that is connecting the smart home. My name is Dirk Niemeyer, a social futurist interested in systems that will make the quality of our lives better. My partner is Jonathan Follett, a writer, composer, and emerging tech researcher. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 8 of Creative Next, a show about future-proofing creatives in a world of AI automation. Let's get started. What does the smart home mean to you? For some, it is a prompt to look around and reflect on the devices you've been using for some time already. For others, it is popular products like the Roomba and Nest that you haven't tried yet. For still others, it may be old Jetsons cartoons with a robot maid and wacky automation everywhere. This disparity is, in part, because the killer app hasn't landed yet. That one piece of technology that moves smart home functionality from a niche convenience to what most people here in the United States might consider an essential. As we talked about last episode with voice experience expert Karen Koshansky, a forcing function that might accelerate smart home adoption is our work. Telecommuting is at an all-time high. According to a 2019 report from Fundera, employees who work from home are generally more productive, have a higher income, have less turnover, cost the company less, and is a feature proactively sought out by millennials. That's a lot of positive benefits. Even still, while listeners to this show are probably exposed to telecommuting either in their own work or anecdotally through their friends, only 7% of all employers in the United States offer telecommuting flexibility to their employees. The trend is real, but the statistics are also a reminder that many jobs don't lend themselves to working from home. The prevailing wisdom, and sometimes physical reality of things, is that you need to be there, well, physically. As time goes on, there is every indication that the distinction between home and workplace will increasingly blur. Still, we aren't there yet. Where we are, in fact, is our home as an emerging smartware environment, one that is increasingly diverse, stable, and dependable. It is interesting even only for how we are living our lives, as it foreshadows how the ways we work will evolve as well. We're pleased to welcome Kent Dixon to Creative Next. He is the CEO of Younomi, a company working right in the heart of the smart home. He shared with me the long history of smart homes, starting as a luxury for the wealthy or the gearhead decades ago. Let's pick the conversation up later as Kent transitions to talking about home automation today.
Since the original sort of chapters of home automation, we've iteratively evolved to where we are today with hundreds of hardware vendors building compelling and comparatively cheap devices that communicate wirelessly, in most cases, on the local network and up to the cloud. The ubiquitousness of bandwidth and the reliability of broadband, together with the inexpensive cloud computing, has really enabled that to come to pass. The connected devices today are cheaper and have arguably much higher utility than they did in the past. And that's directly because of the cloud. Those things would not be possible without the cloud. It's a non-starter for mainstream users to have a server room in their home, of course. Who's going to perform the ops on that infrastructure, the maintenance, who's going to replace it when it inevitably becomes sort of obsolete within a year or so, that server infrastructure, who's going to do the remote control, which is part of the compelling feature set for smart home, is that when you're not there, you can see what's happening and or you can control what's happening from your vacation or your office or your car or wherever you may be.
One of the challenges with old smart home technology is it required sophisticated installation and maintenance. Today, it is driven by the cloud, the decentralized computing environment that increasingly seems to connect everything, combined with the availability and affordability of Internet of Things hardware devices, the platform is in place for rapid growth and utility in our homes and other physical spaces. To understand this opportunity with more context, let's learn about what Yonomi does.
Yonomi is a software company. We make no devices, but we have built out a software platform that allows us or you as a consumer or you as a device or service maker to get those devices connected to the cloud and coordinated in a way that is sensible and useful. And we think that's a really important job. In the space of IoT, and particularly the smart home, there are no standards. There's no common brain that we all have, you know, sort of in our home that's able to do these things. And furthermore, there's new devices and new services and, frankly, new innovations and ideas that come out every day. And so we're really just trying to be, you know, a piece of cloud infrastructure that reduces the cost of cloud computing so that great ideas and great capabilities can come to life. We have a big impact on the ability to get those devices or those services, those apps to market faster so that people can take advantage out of them, and be able to build, you know, interesting, compelling businesses around those as well. And we think that we have a really important role in this at the end of the day to make to the consumer that all feel seamless. I don't feel like I have to have a computer science degree to make my stuff work together. It just works and it does what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. And along the way, my privacy was protected.
In the old days of home automation, the owner would need to maintain a physical hardware server. While the cloud inherently obsoletes that need, there is still the need for some software to empower and federate the ecosystem. That's what Yonomi is doing. To be honest, I was surprised that a company like Yonomi was able to compete in that space, because the big boys of technology, your Amazon, Google, and Apple, are conspicuously competing for the same space. They would seem, by virtue of their wealth and girth, if nothing else, the obvious platform owners.
I think that's a really important question. It goes back to how we often describe our platform, is it's open and agnostic. There are big megatechs in this business, no doubt, and they do part of what we do in terms of integration and automation and enabling some of these experiences. They play a very important role. But when you think about the megatechs, the Apples, the Amazons, the Googles, what they're not is agnostic. Sure, they may have sometimes the ability to claim some level of openness, but they are not agnostic. And so you, if you're an application developer, if you're a device maker, you have to play with all those guys. You can't just say, okay, I'm making a decision, I'm going into this walled garden. You know, I'm going to be in the Alexa ecosystem, or I'm going to be in the iOS or the Apple ecosystem, and that's just that. That would be foolish for you to intentionally cut off part of your addressable market. By using Yonomi, we work with everybody. We don't have a horse in the race at all. We basically just have a software platform that is there for exactly what we say it's there for. It's for making things work, to communicate to the cloud and work together in a seamless way. We don't have an advertising engine. We don't have a mobile operating system that we have a preference for. We sell no hardware. So we're there to be friend, not foe, in every position. Because we hear from our customers and partners all the time that, you know, some of these megatechs are frenemies. Well, we're friends. There's no enemy in what we do here, you know.
I wonder if eventually the big techs of the world just deploy their own end-to-end ecosystem, app store style, that disenfranchises a player like Yonomi. Still, Yonomi's role in the ecosystem of today and tomorrow is an obviously important one. Let's understand better the problems that Yonomi is helping to solve.
We felt that what's important is the experience that the user is trying to have. Increasingly, in connected homes, those experiences involve multiple devices, not just a single device. So when you watch TV, for example, you don't want to verbally enumerate every device change along the way. Alexa, turn on the TV. Alexa, pause the music. Alexa, dim the overhead light. Alexa, adjust the temp, et cetera, et cetera. You just want to say, Alexa, turn on TV time, and all of those things just happen. Yonomi helps define those experiences or scenes in what we call routines, and then make those routines accessible to Alexa or to Google or to Siri or other non-voice interface, your smart watch or your phone widget screen. So really, we've kind of focused much of our efforts in delivering this utility to users through the idea of defining those activities or routines and then surfacing those so that they're the most convenient thing that you can have your voice assistant or your wearable or what have you do for you on your behalf. What's really interesting about physical spaces and devices and the lifestyles in those physical spaces is that in many, if not most cases, the best UI is not a graphical user interface. It might be voice at certain times. It might be gestures. It might be tapping a wearable or moving a wearable. But in other cases, it might actually just be automation that says, hey, at sunset, these are the things that should happen. Or, hey, when I leave the house, these are the things that should happen. And those things happen invisibly and in the background. The best technology, as has been said, is largely invisible. And so that's really for us as designers of smart home experiences, that should always be our number one goal, is that the user experience is largely invisible and takes very little sort of effort and interaction by the user to make the right thing happen. You know, we use this term smart home broadly. For the most part, where the industry is about what I would call obedient homes. We're still at the point where we're trying to get the devices and the home to do what you tell it to do. In the future, we'll sort of graduate bit by bit to what a real smart home is, where it anticipates context of what you're doing and what you might need in assistance at that particular moment, and then start to subtly do some of those things on your behalf. What they want is their devices to communicate with a central coordinator of some sort, or brain, if you will, in order to achieve an outcome or an experience. I mean, think about the act of clapping. Your right hand doesn't, quote unquote, talk to your left hand in order to clap. Your brain does that job. Your brain says it's time to clap and then sends those commands out and coordinates that activity.
Platform flexibility is smart. Yonomi's strategy to shift across interfaces, instead of specializing in something like voice, gives them the most flexibility to adapt to the market. I particularly like Kent's insight that the most powerful things will happen through automation, not interface. Having your smart home writ large proactively adapt based on your lifestyle and preferences is an example of technology at its very best. That's when it feels like magic, when things are happening that the visitor observes and says, I've got to have one of these. It's solutions like that, which aren't just obedient, but federating, or even prescient, that the smart home of today, already easy and convenient for the average person to get started with, becomes a requirement like the smartphone before it. What are some smart home applications that Kent thinks are particularly useful today and may in a more local way accelerate the adoption of smart home technologies by everyday consumers?
One of the examples that leaps out at me is Amazon Key. Amazon Key is this idea that the delivery person bringing that Amazon package to your home doesn't have to leave it on the front porch if you're not there. They can actually securely put it inside the door and close the door. And that temporary access can be granted in real time and then revoked. And there's something there that actually records that transaction, so you know that nothing unusual or untoward happened during that, because obviously it's a sensitive topic. But that completely changes the game for package delivery, which is, you know, more and more of part of all of our lives. And that would not be possible without cloud computing and without smart devices like smart locks and cameras.
Amazon Key offers valuable use cases. particularly for dense urban environments where the nature of the physical infrastructure makes doormat delivery inherently less secure. Kent mentions cameras as part of that solution. In my anecdotal experience, cameras performing a monitoring or security role is how the smart home is most actively spreading its wings. It has become common that news stories relating to home robberies or other crimes mention the use of cameras, such as the homeowner reporting the crime from some remote locale. Cameras have become a ubiquitous part of our lives thanks to the smartphone. Their low cost, convenience, and obvious utility makes them an ideal accessory to getting the average consumer to think about the smart home being for them. Let's continue.
And there's another example that I think is really interesting and compelling. And I hope we're not to the point yet where we're so used to this that it's no longer amazing to us. But think about a Roomba, the vacuum cleaner that's a robot. And today, what you can do, if you've got an Alexa in your home and a modern Roomba, you can say, Alexa, clean the TV room. And not only does that robot know what you meant, what your intent by that command was, it knows where the TV room is and will go directly there and clean that room and only that room because that's what he was instructed to do. Those two examples of Amazon Key and Roomba by themselves are just, you know, completely unfathomable types of things that that didn't exist, you know, 5 years ago.
I'd be willing to bet that most of us listening to this do not own a Roomba. This despite the fact it was introduced almost 20 years ago now, and current versions are truly minor miracles of effectiveness relative to their super specific job. Speaking for myself, part of it is that it feels unnecessary. We already own a vacuum cleaner. Vacuuming the floor, with the exception of moving furniture and picking up toys, neither of which the Roomba is capable of doing, is a quick and simple chore. The Roomba feels like overkill. Another factor is that I'm just a little scared of the Roomba. Now, scared is not quite the right connotation, but it is a complex and expensive piece of machinery. Investing the money and effort to bring that into my home, with an unknown array of potential maintenance or repair responsibilities to follow, is exhausting even to think about. I'd rather just use the damn vacuum. Still, all of that said, I do think the Roomba is pretty darn amazing. Roomba is also notable for being one of the smart home solutions that heavily incorporates artificial intelligence. What are Kent's thoughts on the future of AI in smart homes?
Today, AI does a few things in the smart home. Obviously, the voice assistants have a form of AI in their natural language processing and trying to guess what you really meant by what you said. So there's some there for sure that we see every day. Some devices themselves and services that go with them are trying to learn your patterns and make smart decisions for you. You know, the Nest learning thermostat is an example of that. But it's rather limited still at this point in time what AI is doing for us.
Fair enough. You know me, like much of the smart home industry, is dealing primarily with the issues of our living as opposed to our working. But given Kent's deep immersion in that context, I'm curious about his thoughts on how the emerging smart home relates to the future of work.
It's really about personalization and customization of the things around you at the right time. That's what we're doing in the home today. The home is a bit more self-contained maybe than many workplaces are. There's fewer residents and or visitors that come and go from a home. But it is sort of a template, I think, for how things might translate into the workplace, even though the use cases will become a bit more complex at times, in that there will be more users, many of them will be transient, the devices will be of different types, and some will be the same, some, you know, just translate straight across. I mean, you know, we've got HVAC at home as well as in the workplace. We've got lighting and access control of doors and that type of things. So I think the technology will, in fact, translate pretty well to the workplace, but it's just that the use cases get slightly more complex.
It makes sense that advances in the home will extend not just how we work within that home, but into the physical infrastructure of the formal workplace itself. Kent's emphasis on personalization and customization there returns back to where the magic probably lives. We work and live in macro environments. For example, our homes generally have one thermostat, regardless of the varying environmental preferences we each uniquely have. It is a clumsy macro solution that threatens to leave everyone uncomfortable. The more that these technologies are enabling each of our own micro environments of customized comfort, the more effective and essential they will become. I've mentioned a couple of times the lack of a killer app in the smart home environment, and I asked Kent what he thought it might end up being.
Using the analogy of the iPhone or smart homes and sort of what that unleashed in terms of innovation and what were the killer apps around that is a really apt one. The home will be an API. And because it's an API that basically can surface, here are the devices I have and the control that they can receive from me. Here's the context or sensory events that I can bubble up. This is my API for home, and my home is different than your home. However, I think by having that common sort of API available, we unleash a lot of quote-unquote apps, if you will, that will see startups and big companies alike suddenly innovating like crazy because now there's this software layer, this software platform, not unlike what the iPhone really represented, is a bundle of sensors and screens and GUIs. And once you turn developers loose on that, you see so much innovation. Think about all the businesses that exist today that wouldn't have existed before the smart home. Uber is a great example that couldn't have existed. And some of them will be very targeted use cases. You know, they'll be around security in some cases, or aging in place, or supporting people staying in their homes longer. They may be about entertainment. They may be about energy management efficiency. They may be about any number of other things, supporting disabled people, for instance. We'll see just a stunning set of new capabilities and features, which I don't know that we've got the language for it yet. I still keep saying quote-unquote apps, but we'll probably call them something else in the future.
Kent isn't really able to put his finger on any one sort of thing that would be the killer app, but rather the way that a fertile, integrated, open platform will create the environment for one to emerge. That's fair enough, but it also makes me think that shifting the smart home from convenience to essential might be a ways away in that case. Going back to the smartphone example, we could see the revolution coming years before it arrived. It just took Apple's app ecosystem to move the obvious to the accessible. One of the things that has concerned me about the smart home for some years is the retrofitting of existing homes to make it work. In my admittedly ignorant and wild imagination, the barrier of needing to remove plaster and chipboard walls in order to install interactive and digitized walls is wholly impractical. But my more complicated vision for how this would come together may be wrong-minded. Let's hear from Kent.
I don't think the retrofit issue is an inhibitor to smart home adoption. The devices, the smart devices that are now available for homes are wirelessly communicating devices, implies that, you know, you didn't need to build that as a smart home to begin with. You can bring it in. You don't have to have special wiring for it or anything else. You plunk that new thermostat in the same place where the old dumb thermostat was. It joins the Wi-Fi network and it's off to the races doing its job. Same with your smart lock or your smart TV or your smart light bulb or your switch. You can replace these things one by one. And this is very true to the journey of the smart home, is you don't wake up one day and say, you know what I want to go get today? A smart home. Nobody does that. What you do is you have this sort of very specific things like, oh, I'm wasting a ton of water with this sprinkler system that I have because it doesn't know that it rained. And I'm not always, you know, at home, I travel and I can't go out and turn it off. So I suddenly get a smart sprinkler for that particular purpose. And then likewise, smart thermostat shows up maybe a few months later because I had similar sort of inspiration, or a smart lock came onto my door because I'm going to Airbnb this place, or I want to enable Amazon keys so they can deliver inside the door. And oh, by the way, for security reasons, I want some smart lighting or a doorbell or whatever. And so one by one, you get these things. They don't cost very much. You don't have to rewire your home for them. It's compatible with the home just as it is today. And before you know it, you do have a smart home.
The vision of smart home as a process instead of an event is, well, smart. We will start with cameras or a doorbell or a thermometer or a vacuum cleaner. And from there, we'll be in the smart home sorority. As we adopt one solution successfully, the next will seem that much easier. And then the next, and then the next. To wrap up, what are some risks and challenges to the growth and development of smart homes?
When it comes to the home, these impacts will be very material, but probably more subtle and small than folks might assume. Because the chance for there to be a bad user experience by getting something wrong, like turning on the lights or turning off the music at the wrong time, the chance for that happening is really high. AI either has to nail it every time or don't do it at all. The advances we'll probably see will be a bit more, call it collaborative, with the user. When the machine learns something that might be useful to you, they need to find a way to confirm with you in a subtle and non-irritating way that, in fact, that is something you want to do and that it's okay to kind of do that automatically in the background from now on. But that's really hard to do in a way that is subtle and not irritating. It's going to be different for me than it is for you, my experience and my sort of evolution. But I think that's what we'll see when it comes to machine learning and AI. It'll show up in small ways, a little bit at a time. It's not going to come in one big wave and suddenly the house always knows exactly what I want and does it for me before I have to ask for it and everything's nirvana. That's not going to happen. So we as an industry, whether we're device makers or we're app makers, if you will, are going to have to be very cautious and, you know, we'll do the low-hanging fruit first and do the things that clearly add value. And after that, we're going to have to be very respectful and very cautious about introducing new things, because the moment that the music starts playing at 4 o'clock in the morning because we assumed that that's what you wanted, yet you were in deep REM, that's the day you start unplugging your smart home devices. None of us want that.
Thanks again to our guest, Kent Dixon. So, John, how did our interview with Kent impact your thinking about the work we are doing with Creative Next?
Well, Kent talked a bit about the elements of the smart home and how they might translate into our workplace. And it got me thinking about this idea of physical context switching, which we do all the time. We sort of bring our digital footprint with us, by bringing our phones or our laptops with us into, you know, whatever the next environment is. But it's really sort of a kludgy transformation, because when I'm at work, I use my laptop in a certain way, and when I'm at home, I use it in another way. So the potential for physical context switching, aided by your digital footprint, is something that's, I think, attractive to me and probably other creative people as well. I mean, you hinted at it a little bit in your description as well, Dirk. You know, this idea that, you know, we're sort of at the very beginnings of this, but you're going to have environments that sort of aid you and transform to your particular preferences. You know, you talked about, you know, something like like the temperature of the room or the way the lights are, things like that. I mean, that could apply to, you know, a whole range of environmental controls and work controls. So when I was listening to Kent talk about these things, I let my imagination run wild, and it was a lot of fun.
Nice. Yeah, you know, listening to Ken, it made me realize that smart environments, in any sort of mainstream way at least, are still a ways away. You know, we need them to be automated. We need them to work in harmony with each other to create environments like sort of you're alluding to that we see in sci-fi movies, or even the sort of things that the old established clunky versions of home automations had to offer in the old days with the physical server. You know, those were solutions that were somewhat magical. You'd have a keypad and you would have done a lot of pre-programming so that you push a button that says, like, you know, mood environment, and the lights and the sound and the perhaps the TV screen, all these different elements all at once then shift to move you from, you know, context A to context B, so to speak. You know, we're certainly not there yet with the more modern, cheaper, more lightweight stuff. So it just seems like it has a long way to go. I think it will come. I think it is coming. It's just slow, which is frustrating. Although perhaps it gives us more time sort of as a culture and a collective to prepare for it as well.
Yeah. I mean, I can only think of sort of the culture pre-mobile phone and the culture post-mobile phone, right? Because pre-mobile phone, it was highly unlikely that someone was going to be staring at a glass brick while walking down, you know, Mass Ave in Arlington and nearly run you over. I mean, they would have run you over for other reasons, but there is going to be a culture shift with each one of these, you know, sort of smartware technologies. How great that culture shift will be, I'm not sure, but I mean, there is a major culture shift in association with mobile computing, one that we're still sorting out right now and trying to, you know, regulate. So, you know, maybe slow is better.
Maybe. So what did Kent say that was the biggest surprise or new kernel of knowledge for you?
So I don't think I'm as conversant in the history of the smart home prior to this interview to, you know, have really understood sort of the great amount of hardware that was required early on, and that the shift to cloud computing was so important to this, you know, next wave of smart home innovations. In my mind, the cloud and the smart home weren't as tightly connected. You know, especially you know, when I'm thinking about the smart home, I'm thinking about that physical spot. And I'm not thinking about cloud computing per se, which in some ways is a little alarming when you think about how big tech has its tendrils into the smart home, and how really, like, say your Nest thermostat is really your Google thermostat. It sounds much nicer that it's Nest, right? That feels warm and cozy. But the fact is that, you know, Google has its tendrils into that data. And so this notion of the cloud being part of the connective tissue of the smart home, as opposed to the sort of in-place technology, that was a bit of an eye-opener for me, just because it was not part of my perspective beforehand.
Yeah, and that old school home automation stuff is still going on. I was familiar with it because a friend of mine lives in Los Angeles and installs those systems for celebrities. His sort of standard opener at parties is that he did it for Russell Brand and Katy Perry, which is getting dated now because I think they've been apart for a while. But knowing him and talking with him about it, I learned a lot about those systems, and they are big and complex. And he's deploying a whole team of people to install it. And the people who he's employing are, you know, he's people he's calling, you know, cable pullers, right? So you've got people crawling around the house, laying intricate cable through the walls and up and down and hither and yon to get these giant mansions all tied together into this one centralized system. So there's a lot of heavy infrastructure there. And so, you know, that sort of in response to what you were saying, but also that contributes to sort of my biggest surprise in talking to Kent. I was really surprised that retrofitting homes wouldn't be a big hassle and expense. I mean, I mentioned in the main script my concerns about destroying walls as one example. But, you know, think back to the last episode, the mixed reality environment that Karen Koshansky talked about. At some point, to get the most out of it, I imagine shifting from, you know, analog home infrastructure into at least parts that are digital in highly intrusive ways. And so maybe that won't be the case hearing Kent, which would be a good thing, particularly in making these things more accessible to more people. So what did you learn from Kent that has influenced your life and how you're living today?
Yeah, I think, from Kent, I got this picture of an adaptable, an adaptable home that responds, responds to your needs. And in that, I've started to, rethink the way I'm configuring my house. And I spoke a little bit about this before, but just this idea that I usually change myself to, fit with my environment. And the idea that the environment would also change to accommodate me is a tantalizing offer. And so I've been taking, little steps to make that happen even more so. I did like your comments about how as we're going through this process, we're adopting one thing at a time. And I think I'm moving to the next stage of adoption, based on all our discussion around smart homes on the show.
Yeah, and you're a couple steps ahead of me. You tend to get into technology a little bit earlier than me. You have a little more toughness where that's concerned. I bounce off it a little too quickly. But with that said, I'm both less interested in yet more open to exploring how the smart home can work for me. Less interested in that, hearing Kent talk, I'm not hearing of any solutions that I'm getting super excited about. There's nothing I heard that was like, wow, I need to get started. So it's sort of a confirmation that there's nothing there for me at the moment, at least. And yet I'm more open to it because of how easy it all seems. There's less required physical infrastructure. It's affordable. It's easily deployed. And so if there was a solution that seemed really cool, I would be more likely to buy it, having talked to Kent, because I have a little more faith in it being something that would just work instead of being a frustrating experience that is some combination of me angrily on the phone with customer service and or the device just sort of flaccid and unplugged, gathering dust in my house.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about, too, is sort of the curse of the early adopter. And, I've written some about this because there is a graveyard, and any sort of technology-oriented geek will have a drawer of, of artifacts, over the years that have just become, you've spent so much money on them that you can't bear to, get rid of them, but they occupy drawers and boxes and things like that. It's interesting because, in some ways this, it's very wasteful to have these sort of early on prototypes of devices that are going to, create this better working environment for us. But I do think you learn something by understanding the technology early, and it also helps you appreciate it a little bit more once it's a smoother experience. So that's my excuse.
No, it's true. And you're certainly more literate in the technologies, and you're more able to adapt the good ones to work well for you more quickly. So each episode, we finish up with a thing to think about, one question germane to what's been covered on the show today. This episode's thing to think about is, what smart home solution can you imagine that it would motivate you to join or expand your participation in the smart home community? Think about that for yourself and feel free to tweet at us about it at GoCreativeNext. Creative Next is a proud member of Civil, a community-owned platform for independent journalism. Learn more at civil.co, that's civil.co. We are sponsored by GoInvo, a design practice dedicated to innovation in healthcare, whose clients are as varied as AstraZeneca, 3M Health Information Services, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Learn more at goinvo.com. We're also sponsored by Design Museum Foundation, a new kind of museum. They believe design can change the world. They're online, nomadic, and focused on making design accessible to everyone. Their mission, bring the transformative power of design everywhere. You can learn about their exhibitions, events, magazine, and more at designmuseumfoundation.org. Our final sponsor is Biff. As a purpose-driven firm, Biff is committed to bringing design strategy where it is needed most. Healthcare, education, and public service to create value for our most vulnerable populations. To learn more and connect, visit them at biff.is. That's biff.is. Please subscribe to Creative Next on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us at Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can get in touch with us at the Creative Next website, creativenext.org, or follow us on Twitter at @GoCreativeNext. On Medium, we are partnered with Towards Data Science, where we publish articles to extend and build upon these episodes. Check out all that Towards Data Science has to offer at towardsdatascience.com. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, whom you can reach at @dniemeyer, and my partner in crime is Jonathan Follett, who is at John Follett. Thanks to our guest Kent Dixon, who is on Twitter at Kent Dixon. Tweet to us with questions, comments, topics, guest suggestions, and include the hashtag CreativeNext. And the home base for everything we do is at creativenext.org. We recommend you sign up for our low-volume newsletter there. That's it for Creative Next Season 2, Episode 8, but here's a clip of what you can expect to hear next time. We'll see you then.
A really good place to focus attention if you're trying to build something meaningful is something that everyone does and no one likes.